Welcome to the Swapflix podcast. My name is Brandon Lede.
Hi, I'm Allie.
And I am Boomer.
And you are listening to the 100th Lanyap episode of this podcast.
Wow. It's been a long road getting from there to here.
I mean, if you think back to the start of the pandemic, that does not feel that long ago, but it's been over 4 years. And, we started this as a side project during that time because I thought, I have some extra time in my schedule now, and my hand was kind of forced in learning how to record online instead of in person. So I got to rope in the two Swampflix contributors who are out of state. And it has since blossomed into not a side project. This is a very significant part of my schedule now.
This is a significant part of your heart.
Yes.
Okay.
You have this stepchild.
I have a complex. I really do. Sorry.
I guess it is like the Swampflix podcast with an asterisk, I hear what you're saying. By saying Lanyap, I'm like saying this is extra. It's on the side.
Yeah, we're just a little extra.
We're like grits or grace. You don't have to order it. It just comes.
To be fair, my original pitch for this was that we would talk for about 30 minutes an episode, maybe do a quick 15 on things we've been watching and then another 15 on like one movie. That is not how this is developed. It is just as long as the episodes we recover four films with four contributors.
To be fair, I think the first episode we did when it was just you and me for a little bit there, I think your suggestion was Death Spa, and I don't know how you thought we would ever cover that in only 15 minutes.
Well, speaking of looking back that far, I did a commemorative thing for this episode. I went back and noted down all of our bumper music, like all the tracks I've played between segments on the show since the start, and created a playlist on Spotify called Lanyap Pod Tracks.
Ooh.
I will share the link of that in the notes of the show. And it was kind of like a trip down memory lane. Like, I could see from this list that like the second episode was already a Star Trek episode because it's a Leonard Nimoy song. I can see how far back it was that we watched the copycat movie because The Police's Murder by Numbers is such an obvious pull from that film, It took me back.
Yeah.
So if you have any affection for the show to the point where you're actually listening all the way to the end, which I don't think anybody does for any podcast, maybe that list of songs would be interesting to you.
I do.
If you don't like this show, maybe you could contact the record labels. I've given you a list of violations you can follow up on. Get it shut down.
This is the only podcast that I'm on and the only podcast that I listen to. And I always listen to the end.
Have you forsaken June Diane Raphael?
I love those. I usually let those build up because the problem was they started getting more film projects again and weren't doing the podcast as regularly. And I also don't love it as much when June's not there. Not that Paul and Jason aren't hilarious on their own or with their guests, but like June has my heart now and forever. There was a joke that she made at the live recording that we did, or that they did when they did the Matthew McConaughey movie Serenity. And I attended that live recording and she swore us all to silence. And therefore we have a special bond.
You're in the inner circle.
Yeah. I guess.
I do have one more announcement, but I'm going to save that for the next segment because I think it has more to do with our main topic than anything else we're going to talk about today. So what have y'all been watching since the last time we talked?
Well, unfortunately or fortunately, I have a new job that is pretty intense. I'm becoming a bus driver. So I have been waking up at 4:30 every morning to get to work to learn how to drive a bus. So not really anything, because I just have been feeling a little zombified. But my life basically is a movie about bus driving. So if anybody wants to pick my brain and write a screenplay, I'm here.
Maybe we should cover Patterson at some point. I haven't seen it, but it's a Jim Jarmusch film in which Adam Driver drives a bus. It has like a very zen zonk.
It's the role he was born to play.
I was going to say, what an appropriate role for such a named person.
And his middle name is Bus, I think.
Yeah, Adam Bus Driver.
That's right.
That's correct.
That, I have Bus no follow up questions about that statement or that claim.
But no, I've hit some yellow cones. I did my first drive on the road on Friday, which was kind of wild. I only ran over the curb twice, so watch out, road.
Look out. I'm sorry, Alec.
Watch out, road.
I do still have stress dreams about the 1 year I drove a Jazz Fest, which was like the year that Elton John played, and there were just like too many people out there. And I still have dreams every time the festival happens where I can picture myself driving the van into a crowd of people and I have no control over the brakes.
I was going to say, I don't know if either of y'all have ever driven a 40-foot long bus, but...
Terrifying.
It's a lot. I mean... It's pretty exciting. Like, you feel kind of powerful about it. So, like I said, any filmmakers want to pick my brain, let me know. I'll tell you all about Bus Driving Boot Camp.
That's a title right there. Very Police Academy.
Yeah. It's fun and exciting. So, yeah, that's been my life. I have not... There's no time for movies. There's only bus. So, yeah. What have you all been watching? Anything cool?
Well, I just want to say thank you for your service, as I say to all bus drivers everywhere. Every friend group has that one person who's obsessed with public transportation and or the library, and that's me.
Hey, that's me and my friend group.
Yeah, I have had people, someone recently asked me, is the library sponsoring you? Because you bring it up a lot. And it's like, just in personal conversations.
Oh my God.
It saves me so much money. This podcast is partially funded by the New Orleans Public Library System.
And by the Austin Public Library System.
And listeners like you.
Yeah. Without Hoopla, Tubi, and the public library, this podcast may not exist.
Yeah, that's true.
If you've never bought a zine from us, you have never given us a dollar. I just want to put that out there.
Yeah.
That funding is very slow trickle from the listeners like you.
Not that we're judging you. You did ask, you know, what have we been watching? And longtime listeners to the podcast are aware, probably, or may have long forgotten, that in the summer of 2022, I declared that the summer of the Coen brothers and set out with the intention of watching them all in chronological order from beginning to end. And I got, we got like a solid 75% of the filmography handled in that summer. And then it's been a very slow trickle, speaking of slow trickles, for me to finish the rest of that oeuvre over the course of like the following, you know, 21 months or so. But I did finally watch the last movie that I needed to like complete this like puzzle, this mosaic, which was No Country for Old Men. I had, of course, seen it before, but not since like it came to home video, like right after its initial theatrical release. Brandon, I know that you are generally Coen brothers apathetic. Allie, I'm not sure that I recall what your feelings about them are. Do we have specific strong feelings about No Country?
I have tried to watch this movie about four times and fallen asleep every single attempt. Just very solidly not for me.
Hmm.
And I know the big debate at the time was like, what's a better film, this or There Will Be Blood? To which I respond, are you insane? How is that even a conversation?
It's interesting because they come up in conversation with each other because they're both sort of neo-Westerns of their own type. And of course, you know, they were made at the same time with that whole story about how there was the day they had to shut down filming on No Country because the oil derrick fire practical effect from from There Will Be Blood was like affecting their ability to shoot because you could see it on the horizon. This, people generally think of this as their magnum opus, and I don't know that I necessarily agree. For one thing, I generally prefer their comedic work.
Yeah, I like it when they goof around.
Yeah. I mean, with the caveat that their goofiest movie is also their worst movie. But like Raising Arizona, even now that I've seen all of them, it remains my favorite. And I like it additionally whenever they blend sort of the terrible drama with the dry wit in something like Fargo, right? Mm-hmm. But I like it when they swing for the fences and do like a full Hail Caesar. Like, that's what I really enjoy. This is, you know, I'm sorry that you haven't made it through, Brandon, but this is an amazing movie. I mean, it is stunning to me. And especially watching it within a week after my own like cross Texas journey, where I went from Austin to Amarillo and then Amarillo to Denver and then back again. And I've just recently experienced being out there in all of that empty Texas country. And when I was going through it, I did not feel unanxious. I'm sorry, I made that overly complicated with too many negatives. I did feel anxious and wary and uncomfortable and a little creeped out because there is so much empty space out there. And it's not like I've never taken cross-country trips by car before. I've driven that Austin to Baton Rouge or Austin to New Orleans pipeline many times. You know, Baton Rouge to Natchitoches, Natchitoches to Shreveport, Baton Rouge to Raleigh, you know, Baton Rouge to Georgia. But those places are not as empty as like the desert empty Northwest Texas is. And that's where this takes place. And having just experienced just this sort of like feeling that you get when you just don't see anyone, you're the only person on the road. It feels apocalyptic. It feels like you're the last person on Earth. And this movie manages to capture that feeling of this big, empty Texas and corporealize it in this form of Anton Chigurh as this, you know, Javier Bardem is this like killer, unstoppable, Terminator-like killer, which is why I'm a little surprised you haven't made it through this one, Brandon, because I know of how much you love Terminator.
I'll concede that the villain is a great character, and that's the reason I've tried to watch the movie several times.
Yeah.
I'll also concede that I am biased against the Western landscape. I find it boring visually.
And you and I have had this conversation before because you had that same sort of reaction to Dune, it yes. having that desert landscape.
Oops, all browns.
And I'm not going to disagree with you. You know, I spent a lot of time growing up watching a lot of terrible, boring Westerns that I would never watch again. And I completely understand what you're saying. And so I think that Westerns that are effective are few and far between. And this one is really something special. I'm not, generally, I'm not a huge Tommy Lee Jones advocate. I think his work speaks for itself for the most part, but this is a really great role for him. This is like some of Josh Brolin's best work, I think, and Javier Bardem as well. And a lot of people find the movie kind of anticlimactic because certain parties never have these cataclysmic interactions that you expect them to have or that you think the film is setting up to have. I love that subversion of typical storytelling where, you know, sometimes stories aren't shaped like stories. And I like that.
I can think of exactly one mechanism that would get me to watch that movie all the way through.
And what is that? Is it MST3K?
No, it's Lanyap Podcast.
I was going to say, I can think of a podcast that would cause both of us to watch it because I also have not watched it all the way through.
Really?
But mine, for the exact opposite reason of it stressed me out at the point in time in which I was trying to watch it. I was like, this is too stressful.
It's a very stressful movie.
Yeah,
it's a
very stressful movie. This is too stressful. I can't watch it. So, yeah, you could podcast us into it.
Well, maybe eventually. We've got a lot of ground to cover between there and now. I went and saw two new releases. The first of them was Challengers, directed by Luca Guadagnino, who I love his work with the caveat that I have not seen Bones and All. But I think that Call Me By Your Name is genuinely one of the greatest films that I've ever seen. And Suspiria, despite my many, many reservations as Texas's foremost Argento theorist, I thought it was great. I was really impressed by it. I couldn't believe that it worked as well as it did. As far as Challengers goes, this is a much weaker effort narratively. I don't think that it is supposed to be as narratively strong as some of his other works, though. I do think that it is intentionally a film that is made very stylish without necessarily having the same sort of like substance as his other work. But I still feel like this one is of a piece with his other work thematically, even if it's not as narratively strong. And Brandon, I think that you saw this one as well, right?
Yeah. And I kind of felt about it the same way I feel about all Guadagnino movies, in that I really liked it, but didn't love it. And right. I think he's like a great director because he's so consistent, where I know when I go see one of his movies that I'm going to enjoy it. But he's not like a great director in that kind of volatile, like Aronofsky kind of way, where like it could either be a masterpiece or complete dog shit. You know, it's kind of up in the air till you watch it. I know what Guadagnino is going to do, and he's good for that. Like, to consistently make really good movies but never great ones is fine by me.
You're kind of Guadagnino apathetic as well.
I'm not apathetic.
Agnostic, perhaps.
I think he's good. I think he's like a solid guy. He's just consistently solid without ever like wowing me. And I think this movie actually gets closer than most of them do.
Okay.
Personally, this might just be like a taste difference between you and me. I think style over substance is like a bullshit criticism because the style is the substance.
Well, the text is the medium is the message, but the medium also has text in it. And you're right. You and I do often approach it from different ways.
I think the driving force between these three characters, they're all tennis players. One of them, the one played by Zendaya, is pushing these two characters and like constructing a miserable version of their lives to get a great tennis match out of them. It's like a decades long con that she pulls. And when they finally pull it off at the end and she finally sees the great tennis that she wants to see, like that moment feels really good and it ends on a great beat. So like, the really good ending made me appreciate the solidly good movie that came before it. You know, like it was like a 4-star ending to a 3.5-star movie.
Well, for one thing, you and I are interpreting the text differently. I do not think that she engineered that match over the course of that those 13 years.
Then we saw two completely different movies.
I think that at the end, whenever it becomes, she did not plan for Patrick Zweig to show up at the New Rochelle Challengers meeting. His appearance there is an accident. It's one that she uses to her advantage.
It doesn't matter. Okay. She spends the entire movie manipulating those two people from their teenagehood till their adulthood, trying to get good tennis out of them. She is willing to have a child with someone who she does not care about, both the child and the partner, in order to get a good tennis match. Like, all that she cares about is tennis, the whole movie. And that singular obsession is her, like, driving characteristic.
And I agree with you. But my interpretation of the text is that she is simply, it's that she is manipulating her husband specifically because she is living vicariously through him because of the loss of her career. But I think like the goal of having him face off against like his childhood friend and rival is something that falls into their lap rather than
sometimes
something
you get a good
played.
Sometimes the wind like hits you at your back and helps you along a little bit, you know? You
can't and this is a everything. Windy movie.
there is a lot of anime style conversations in the middle of a windstorm to match their emotional storms on the inside. It is really over the top.
Yeah, I think my favorite part was all the wind. So for me, it's just that it's not a very there's so much characterization work that happens here in the edit rather than in the performance.
Yeah.
And there's just something about watching it where I can't not notice that, and I notice that more than I'm like invested in what I'm watching necessarily for this one.
And I was excited by that experiment in form though. Like you wrote in your review, it like the bouncing back and forth between timelines and the way that like conversations would heat up and then the score would like overpower what they were saying just to like underline the fact that their vocal sparring was like another tennis match they were having. Because it scored exactly like the sports scenes. Like, I liked that playfulness in the form. I thought that was, like, really fun to watch.
And I find all of that praiseworthy, but I just didn't connect with it, which was the reason that I ended up having a lower score, really, than probably it sounds like you would have given it.
Like a 0.5-star higher? Who gives a shit?
we're splitting hairs at that point.
But
fire and ice.
I do want to say the score from Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. Fantastic synthwave pop, like really pulsing, exciting club music. And
Gay Twitter is loving it.
I've been frustrated with Guadagnino the last two movies. I can't remember what sequence they were in, but I'm thinking specifically of Call Me By Your Name and Suspiria, where the soundtrack is fine, but I don't want to hear the vocals. I really think Sufjan Stevens and Thom Yorke are super distracting in those movies and really zap those movies of their like magic and just The same way that you thought the...
I couldn't disagree more. So I guess
that the editing was like distracting in this. Like, their voices in those movies just completely ruin the spell. Just completely break me out of it. And this one saves the Trent Reznor vocals to the end credits. And I'm like, finally, you learned something. You should have did this 2 or 3 movies ago.
I mean, I'm going to have to disagree about the usage of Sufjan, especially.
Boo. He's so boring. In general, I never want to hear him.
Wow.
Some words.
I mean, harsh thing to say right now because he's going through a lot and people are very sad alongside him. I don't mean anything personally against the man. I just don't find his movies like interesting. And I listen to a lot of whiny sad boy music. I'm not saying that's like beneath me or anything.
Wait, what is Sufjan going through? No, I'm going to Google it. Don't.
It's very sad.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm sure it's very sad.
Well, I guess before we come to blows over Sufjan and challengers, I guess we can talk about La Bête or La Bête or however you say the beast in French. I loved it. You talked about it last time. This is the movie in which Léa Seydoux goes on a like the fountain style journey through her past lives, in which every single one of them she falls very hard for. The reincarnation of this specific man who, Brandon, you identified in our last episode as like a fuckboy in every time period. And although I do interpret the French section a little, like the 1910s France section a little bit differently, you're not wrong. Because he's definitely terrible in the like 2020s section and in the 2040s section.
I looked up the definition of a fuckboy after we had this conversation the other day. And the like kind of standard definition is like a boy who will do anything to sleep with you, just like completely willing to debase himself and debase you and lie and manipulate to get you into bed. And that's all he cares about. I think this guy fits that description in every segment. And like the kind of the curse of it is that he's always unsuccessful. And he's also handsome and charming in most timelines. So, you know,
yeah, 2 out of 3.
2 out of 3.
The incel timeline in which he reads, he basically recites sections of, you know, paraphrasing of the manifesto of a particular mass shooter who was an incel, who we will not name on this podcast because that's what they want. It's a lot to deal with. It's a struggle. And I really appreciated the artifice of this movie. Because the framing device is that in the 2040s, AI runs everything and people, like, there's 67% unemployment because there's no work. AI just basically makes everything work for people. And then it also offers them this opportunity to, quote unquote, have their DNA purified, which means that they go back and view their past lives and, like, the way that they died and their past traumas. And in so doing, I guess, work through them with the implication that on a more sinister note, they're basically just stripping people of their emotions. So in this like framing device in the 2040s, Léa Seydoux is stuck in like a menial job where she just like every once in a while has to check the temperature of a machine and write it down. It's like really not very fulfilling. She goes so that she can have, she applies for a different job. They tell her that because she's so emotionally volatile, because she's has not had this purification, that she does not qualify for any of these positions. So she agrees to do it after being talked into it by a friend of hers, who we later see in the film is like completely emotionless, like a robot who murders her pet whenever it gets sick. Like, she just euthanizes it while on the phone very casually, yeah, as an illustration of like, you know, purification of all of your emotions via machine is not going to make you the best version of yourself. And in so doing, you know, she relives these things, and for the most part you accept that what she's experiencing is accurate. I liked that the 2010s, 2020 section really played with the what you expect to happen and what's really happening and the filmic nature of it in a way that reminded me of what's that movie with the two boys who in tennis outfits who terrorize a family?
Funny Games.
Funny Games. It sort of rewinds back on itself multiple times, and
yeah, dialogue is repeated verbatim.
Yes, and some of it is repeated verbatim as an illustration of how even these people who have been purged of their emotions are still going through the exact same motions that they were in their past lives. It's illustrated in this scene where Lea Seydoux's contemporary, her 2040 character, or her 2010s character rather, goes out to this nightclub, and she comes upon this table of three women who are sitting there talking, and asks if she can sit with them. And they are like, no, absolutely not. Who do you think you are? You've got to earn that right. And then when she goes to a nightclub in her like present of the 2040s, those same three women, presumably once again reborn in this reincarnation cycle, have the exact same conversation with her, despite the fact that they confirm that they have undergone this emotional purging software update. And so it's made clear to us that this, whatever this is, does not break people out of their old patterns.
They're still dicks.
Yeah. They're still dicks, and they're still going to do exactly what they did in the previous life. That you can't run a program of Buddhism and like enter Nirvana on the next cycle because of an AI. It doesn't work that way. I really liked the period piece segment the most, I think. I love the sumptuousness of the direction. I thought that doll factory fire was really stunning. It was a really great visual, and the underwater sequence that's part of it, all of that is so lovely and beautiful. And then the 2010 segment is much less straightforward and seems what we would call buggier.
I want to pause on that, if you don't mind. That's the part I've been thinking about a lot since I watched the movie, is like the period piece, the Great Flood of 1910, where they're in the doll factory. That feels pretty straightforward. Like, that is a costume drama romance. And then the 2010 stuff is like a time that we are all old enough to remember. Like, I remember what it was like to be alive in 2010.
Unfortunately.
So the uncanniness of like her watching this like karaoke broadcast that just seems like completely
the same song.
BS. Yeah, it's very like Tim and Eric, that part. And like there's a pop-up ad gag, yes, where like her laptop gets infected and it starts playing clips from Harmony Korine's Trash Humpers as a pop-up ad alongside other just like web.
Every time she tries to Google anything about herself,
yeah,
it just is, it all she finds is that Trash Humpers stuff.
So like what I've been thinking about a lot lately is like I did not consider at first how much of what we're watching in the flashback is being filtered through AI distortion. Like, it's not that we're actually traveling to the past and seeing that unedited, or at least in the 2010s part, it feels like the AI is like having a heavier hand in what she's experiencing because the process isn't taking, she's still emotional. She's in the 0.007% of people who it doesn't work on.
Yeah. So we know that we do not see every incarnation of this couple, specifically because they mention a whole lifetime that we didn't see in the 1960s when the song Evergreen was released, that they listened to the song together when it came out, and we don't ever observe that. And I think that is also an indication that the AI is obscuring something. Because like what happened in the 60s that the AI, does she not have to work through it? Was he not a fuckboy in that time period? Or it could also be that the 1910s are much more straightforward and in an era of like much more like overstimulation from media sources, that the AI is having to fill in more things that she maybe doesn't actually remember. And she's on 2CB as well. So it's possible that her memories are very distorted as well.
That is funny, like thinking about it as like a generative AI experiment, because some of the screenwriting feels like AI Mad Libs a little bit. And I think I listened to an interview with him on a podcast last week where he said something like, I was playing with AI before I wrote this movie. And he said that he told like the generative AI thing to like write a Bertrand Bonello script, and it was kind of like a timeline hopping story because he has set movies in different centuries, so like it kind of amalgamated everything he's written. So like one paragraph would be around the time he set like House of Tolerance, I want to say like the 1800s, and one would be set in contemporary France like Nocturama. And so I don't think he used AI to write this movie, but I think he was just thinking about how uncanny it is to create that way.
Yeah, and how imperfect.
Yeah, and I think that 2010 segment, the stuff at the edges of the frame are just so weird. That weird little doll that ties that segment to the doll factory of the earlier one is just impossible. Yeah. Like that thing would not exist at that time, but it's such a weird little object that is never really commented upon. You just kind of have to like disregard it to keep the drama going.
I sort of interpreted the dolls as incarnations of, and the way that companionship is capitalized upon over time. Because in that 1910 segment, they're specifically already in the process of moving away from making ceramic dolls and instead make celluloid dolls, which we would know as plastic baby dolls.
Yeah.
And then that advancement in companionship is present in the 2010 segment with that creepy doll that responds to her sort of like a Furby with flesh. It's
like
very
a Megan
uncanny.
Prototype.
Yes. But then in the 2040s segment, she also is given a companion who introduces herself as a doll.
True.
She's like, oh, and also I'm more like a nurse. I'm here to help you through. So this like role of companionship becomes more commodified over time. And we also know that the woman who is assigned to her to be her nurse slash doll in the 2040s underwent this procedure, or maybe is like a full-on AI like incarnation of an android, although it is left a little bit ambiguous. But she's also like the only woman of color in any of this segment, so it is strange, or not strange, but I think telling that like she is basically a slave,
right?
And there is something about how like it kind of is like AI is not going to provide, like, turning control of everything over to an unfeeling, uncaring machine is something that a lot of people advocate for who are foolish as a way to remove biases from certain, like, processes in real life. But in fact, it doesn't, because the data that it uses to train on came from us, and we are not free from biases. And so we frequently see those biases come through again. And it's interesting that like the AI system that runs everything gave her a black woman as a slave, essentially.
I also want to note that in the 2040s, we do get a glimpse of their like 1960s relationship in a completely fake environment that has removed all meaning from it, which is like the very last beat, which I won't spoil what happens there. But there's a nightclub that changes decades depending on when Seydoux shows up there, and it ends at the 60s in this like swanky nightclub that's like completely empty. And it's another instance of like the AI having removed all context and creativity and life, so that, you know, what should be this big buildup to this emotional payoff is just like empty in a very terrifying, vacuous way.
Yeah.
It's a very dense text. Like,
yeah,
it is something you could pick at forever, I think.
It reminded me a lot of, I've already mentioned The Fountain. If you're a fan of The Congress, I think that you would like this one as well. There's some elements of that that carry over. If you're looking for a less problematic alternative to Cloud Atlas, where instead of it being about how reincarnating with the same people over and over again is a beautiful thing, it tells us that sometimes reincarnating with the same people that you can't get rid of actually is horrible and is a hell unto itself. I think that it has that element of it. There were some others, but I've forgotten them now. So yeah, I do think that we could pick at it forever. Maybe a future topic. I can see it being on some lists at the end of the year this year.
If anybody besides you and me watches it, sure.
Yeah, it could happen. And then finally, the earlier today, I went to a Regal Cinemas flashback cinema screening of Dial M for Murder, scratching off another dark spot in my Hitchcock filmography. Have we seen this one?
Yeah, but it's been a while since I saw it. Like, I think that was one of, when I first went through my Hitchcock stuff, I think that was one of the first ones, so.
Do you remember your feelings about it? Because I have a feeling you would like this one quite a lot.
I remember liking it. You know, murder mysteries are, we love them.
Yeah. It's interesting because in a lot of, I think it's like 2.5 hours. It has an intermission, although Regal Cinema did not provide us with one, and I would have, I would have liked to empty my bladder at that point, but I survived. It plays like a long episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, because those episodes are frequently about some people in some sort of domestic or familial arrangement, you know, parent and child, husband and wife, you know, aunt and nephew who's going to inherit everything. And so many episodes of the show are just about like some person telling another person that they've added them to their will, and party B then becoming obsessed with obtaining that money immediately and setting about to create an elaborate plan to knock off their benefactor. And this movie is that. It's, you know, for those who've never seen it, Dial M for Murder, Grace Kelly is a woman who has a moderate fortune. And she has been engaged in an emotional affair, at least emotional, with an American television mystery writer, who has recently returned to England after having gone back to the States for a year. And 1 year previous, Grace Kelly's husband, who is a retired English tennis player, which I thought was interesting, having just seen Challengers. Tennis is important in this one too, although not nearly as much.
Weirdly, I saw people asking for like best tennis movies after Challengers, and Strangers on a Train came up a lot too.
Oh yeah, because one of those guys is a tennis player. That's true. Well, Grace Kelly's husband, he is this retired tennis player, and the American writer comes back, and he, because the husband knows that there of this affair, he's found out about it, he sends the two of them off to the theater together while he basically gets an old college buddy or an old college classmate of his who he has done some research on and has found out that he's just like constantly leaving behind debts, changing his name and moving to a new town, lures him to the apartment under the pretense of being willing to buy his car that's for sale, and then enlists him in a scheme to kill his wife, Grace Kelly, while Mr. Grace Kelly and American writer are at a party and therefore have a perfect alibi. And he sets up this like meticulous and perfect plan where he's going to call at a certain time, and this old college friend is going to do this. And, you know, when the college friend in the initial conflict is asking, you know, oh, what? Why don't I just go to the police right now and tell them this? He's already got a plan for that. He's very meticulously thought out every eventuality, or so he thinks. And Allie, this is what made me think that you would really like it, is that this feels very much like an early inspiration for Columbo. Because in the entire first act, we have this man setting up, setting his wife up to be killed so that he can inherit everything. It goes awry, and then he sets another plan in motion that seems to wrap everything up neatly. And then in the second half, John Williams, who is an English actor who was in like 9 episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, you'll know him if you see him. He's been in 1,000 things. Shows up as this police officer who investigates, and then eventually Grace Kelly is like going to be hanged. Like, she's been found guilty of maliciously murdering her blackmailer based on the evidence that is found. And then the TV writer guy comes to the husband and says, hey, you know, actually, I have an idea where you could tell this wild story about how you tried to get Swan to kill your wife and it went awry, and it'll get her off of death row. Like, you might serve a couple of years, but it'll keep her from being executed. And then events develop from there to where, you know, they keep trying to trap certain people in lies, and it's very thoughtful. I really enjoyed it. It also reminded me a lot of Alfred Hitchcock Presents in that a lot of those episodes take place on one or two sets. This one was originally a stage play, and it really shows because you basically never leave Grace Kelly's apartment. Every scene occurs there, even like her trial and conviction is done in like six or seven lines of dialogue as like she stands in front of an ever-changing wall of like anxiety colors. It's very impressionistic. Everything that happens outside of their apartment is clearly something that they would have done expressionistically on stage, and it carries over into this. And in fact, the officer character, the detective played by John Williams, is at one point leaving their apartment and then turns around and says, "Wait, one more thing." And it's like, wow, okay. Like, this is very Columbo. So it feels like a cross between, you know, an early episode of Columbo and a long episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents with a lot of dialogue. I mean, everything is dialogue because it was a stage play. There's a lot of crossing and double crossing and like tension over, you know, who's going to find out what and when, and will it mean anything when they do? I really enjoyed it. I would give this one a recommendation. I don't think that it necessarily rises to greatness. It's not The Birds. It's not Notorious. It's not Psycho or Rubendo or Vertigo, but it's very good. It's, you know, I would put it up there with like way above The Trouble with Harry, if we're talking about that as like the median point of quality of his work. And one thing about it is it's also very funny. Like, you wouldn't think it would be, but there's a lot of dialogue in it that is funny both for the time, and some of it is funny because of the way that it has aged. In particular, whenever Mr. Windus, who is the name of Grace Kelly's husband's character, he's lured in this man in order to enlist him in killing his wife, and there's a lot of discussion about a spaghetti dinner. Like, he says that he tailed his wife to a lover's place and that he watched from the street as he cooked spaghetti on a gas ring, you know, like how joking about how like déclassé that is. And then they talk about the spaghetti dinner like twice more in this conversation, to the point where the person who is being extorted into committing this murder is like, "What if I go to the police and I tell them all about this spaghetti dinner and rubbish?" Like, it's very funny in context.
I don't think I've ever seen a movie from him that was not slyly humorous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even Frenzy, which made me so upset. I was like physically ill watching it.
That movie.
It's like so gross. But there were parts that were like very funny and had me laughing as well.
Yeah. At one point, Mrs. Windus says that she came up with an idea. She said, "I had a brainwave," which is very funny to me. Towards the end, she's been made aware that her husband attempted to kill her and then framed her for killing her would-be murderer as a crime of cold blood. She's like, I can't seem to feel anything. I feel like I should be having a breakdown. And the TV writer is like, "Oh, yeah, I mean, you'll have a glorious breakdown in a couple of days. Just you wait." I don't know. It's very funny. The dialogue in this one is funnier than usual for one of these. And the John Williams character in particular kind of feels like not just Columbo, but there's a little bit of a comedy of affectation with him that is in some ways reminiscent of Daniel Craig's Foghorn Leghorn bit that he does in the Knives Out movies, Benoit Blanc. Like, there's a bit of the Benoit about him in the sense that, like, he's a little bit foppish. And in fact, the movie ends with him brushing his mustache. He takes out a little comb and he's calling the police department. And this is not a spoiler. And he just like brushes his mustache. And that's the last frame of the film. Like, it's not meant to be as dark as some of the others, even though it seems like it at first. There's a lot of laying out of plans up top that is like, God, man, this guy's got it figured out. He's going to kill his wife and get away with it. And then it becomes a little bit more farcical in the second half. So it's a little bit divided that way, but I would still give this one a big recommendation. And I've held the floor long enough. Brandon, What have you been watching?
Coincidentally, I was supposed to go see Marnie today for the first time, but I skipped it so I could be social with friends and family. Boo.
That was a good decision. No, Marnie is horrible. I hate that one.
I will watch it eventually. It just seems like I should have seen it by now. Whether or not it's good seems irrelevant to the fact that it's like a major work of his that I've not seen.
Okay. All right. I know I can't talk you out of it. It's I don't enjoy it. It's brutal. It's bleak. It's an ugly example from him. It's like it's really ugly to women.
That's how I felt about Frenzy too.
Yeah, Frenzy, yeah. Is oof.
You're not wrong. So yeah, just a heads up.
Well, I look forward to arguing about that with you in a future episode of the Swampflix podcast.
It's on swampflix.com.
Let's see. I don't have that much exciting to report on. Recently I watched The People's Joker a second time because it moved to a theater I prefer over the first place that I saw it.
Yeah.
The first venue was next door to a active wedding reception, so I heard about half the dialogue because the other half was drowned out by party music. My reasoning seeing it a second time is like, even when you see a good comedy in good conditions, you're gonna miss half the jokes anyway because, you know, people are laughing very loudly. So I was glad I saw it a second time. If anything really jumped out at me on second watch, other than some jokes that I missed the first time, I just love the Penguin in this movie, you know?
Yeah, he's really supportive.
Yeah, he's not like a very important character to the plot. You know, this is a self-portrait of a trans artist who's talking about a lot about her like coming out story and especially her very fraught relationships with her mother and her first boyfriend. You know, it gets very personal and tender. And the Penguin does not have to deal with any of that, but he's just as important to the plot,
right.
Or at least to her like social circle as anybody else. And he's always just around making the Penguin noise. He just goes at the end of every sentence. And it just cracked me up every time. I had very warm feelings towards that character. Like maybe my favorite character I've seen in a movie all year.
I think that the People's Joker is especially relevant to the main topic of our episode today because of some of the way that the visuals are done surreally and in perhaps intentionally so and intentionally poorly so.
You know, it's hyperactive in a similar way. And yeah, it's not hiding the artifice of how it was made in a similar way. But I was thinking watching it a second time, like the structure of it is very conventional.
Yeah.
Considering how out there the editing and visual craft is. Like the talking directly to the camera confessionals are, you know, it's like holding your hand through her life story and kind of like normalizing a lot of stuff that if the movie was just absolute unhinged Tim and Eric style editing the whole time, which is how Vera Drew came up in the comedy world, like it might have been too much for wide audiences. And I think a lot of the reason it's catching on is because it is accessible to people who don't watch overstimulating art films all the time.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it'll go over well with this crew, of course, because we've done multiple Everything is Terrible films.
Yeah.
At this point.
Yeah.
Like we have graduated from that school of style. So I think that it holds up better for us. I did see a friend since the last time that we recorded, and he had seen it, and he did not enjoy it as much as even like my viewing companion, who didn't love it and kind of didn't understand portions of it. This other friend clearly understood it, just is not into that style and did not enjoy it as much. So it's not going to reach everyone, but that should not be a surprise.
Yeah, I think it's like as accessible as a movie like this could be, you know? This is a lot more accessible than The Great Satan. Maybe that will turn some people off, but it's turning off a much smaller percentage of people than would have been turned off by it if it weren't like willing to meet you halfway. That was a very poorly constructed sentence, but
I followed it, and hopefully our listeners will too.
I followed here.
I do have one new thing to bring to the table, though. I saw a movie called Humane, which will be on Shudder later this summer. It is set in the near future. Climate collapse has just completely undone modern living. And in the future, the government has a program that incentivizes you to kill yourself for a payout for your family to keep the population numbers in control. Because, you know, the conditions are not suitable for the number of people who are alive.
They're not humane.
Exactly. So the government comes up with a humane way to deal with the scenario, and they rebrand suicide as like a war that you can enlist in. You know, like it makes it very patriotic. It valorizes it for your family. Like you are sacrificing yourself so your children can live a better life. That kind of thing.
Interesting.
So Peter Gallagher is in it, and he's like the family figurehead of a family that is actually involved with this government program. I think Jay Baruchel is kind of like a mouthpiece on like Fox News type channels selling this enlistment program. And Peter Gallagher is a retired news anchor. He's very wealthy. His family is kind of living in his shadow. And he gathers them all for dinner to tell them that he and his wife have both decided to enlist. The program is for poor people. It's basically like an exploitation program of mostly immigrant workers who want to send money back home.
Mm-hmm.
And the family flips out. It's like, you can't do this. You weren't actually supposed to believe the propaganda. You know, we didn't actually want someone in our family to enlist. We were like selling this really hard to impoverished people who need the money. And they have all these squabbles. Maybe he's kind of wavering on whether or not to do it. And there's a lot of arguments about whether it's like actually a self-sacrifice or if it's like an act of narcissism. Like he wants to secure his family legacy because he's not really proud of what his kids are doing in the world. And then Enrico Corleone shows up, an actor I like a lot. It was Veronica Mars's dad, Keith Mars.
Among other projects.
Yeah.
Enrico Corleone.
He brings fresh air to the film about one third in, like top of the second act. He shows up with a clipboard. And he's like, all right, I'm here to collect two bodies. We're about to kill two people who've signed up for this euthanasia project. And let's go. Let's get it done. And I'm not going to spoil what happens after that. The movie is all set at this family dinner. I will say the trailer gives like everything away. So if you need more to be on the hook, go there. I think it's like a cheap Canadian production. I want to liken it to the Cube series in that it is all single location and like gesturing to this larger fucked up dystopia outside of that single space that it can't afford to actually film. So all the characters are these like mouthpieces for political topics more so than they are like real human beings. Very Cube, you know, but it's at like a mansion. And Enrico Corleone is so funny in this movie as this like bloodthirsty bureaucrat who is not leaving that house without his two bodies. And the other major thing, and I buried the lead on purpose here, is that this movie was directed by Caitlin Cronenberg, another Cronenberg child.
Cronenberg.
It was like a subtweet almost about like living in your father's shadow. She did have a screenwriter she wrote the movie with, so it's not like entirely her vision. But there's a lot of juicy, I think, extratextual, catty humor about Nepo babies and, you know, the family legacy and inheritance and all this stuff that, like, added an extra layer of intrigue to it for me. I really enjoyed this movie for what it is, like, on the level of, like, a cheap production that's, like, biting off more than it can chew. I thought it was like very funny in a dark way, and I got home afterwards and read reviews and no one likes this movie at all. So maybe I shouldn't be telling people to watch it, but I am reporting that I did enjoy myself.
I'm intrigued.
I am also intrigued.
If you're invested in the Cronenberg Nepo Baby project, I think it's an interesting new chapter in that.
I mean, I did not care that much for Infinity Pool. But I did really like the one that we all watched together.
Antiviral.
Antiviral.
Did you ever see Possessor? Yeah, Possessor is so good.
That's probably his best.
Yeah, it is. It's so good.
But I think Infinity Pool is actually a good touchstone for this one in that a lot of what I enjoyed about that movie was the extratextual humor of writing this movie about a guy who's parentage paved the way for him to be a success, and he's just beating himself up because he has writer's block and is a fraud, you know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of extra textual stuff that's pretty juicy there too. And it made the movie funnier to me. Like the fact that he like Brandon Cronenberg created a dominatrix character to beat him up for his like shortcomings as a creative writer. I think it's very funny.
And yeah, I get it. It just didn't connect with me the way that it did with everybody else around these parts. But I'm not going to yuck anybody's yum about it.
I don't think you're alone there. I think most people were pretty mid on it.
Well, I mean, it ended up on our top 10 list. So like okay. Around these particular parts, it was better received by others than by me.
Fair enough. I did look into Cronenberg's children to see how many kids he had. And he does have a third child named Cassandra, his like first daughter, who was an assistant director on his own movies and a few other projects that he did not direct. She was the AD on Existenz most recently, so it's been a while.
Huh. That has been a while.
Great film. Mm-hmm. Maybe Cassandra Cronenberg will join Brandon and Caitlin in the family business again, and we'll see them all shine. I just really find it kind of adorable. Like, I think M. Night Shyamalan's daughter has a movie coming out this summer alongside his new movie as well. And actually, the main topic of this episode was written by a father-daughter duo in a way.
Yeah.
I just find it cute.
This is also, not only is it probably the weirdest movie I've ever seen, it's the movie with the most technical stuff I've ever seen. Like, I've never seen a movie that's used every trick, every in-camera trick, period. You know, from irises at weird points to giant zooms to animation to painted backdrops to video effects. I mean, it has everything. And what's, I think, really interesting is that he was like a commercial director. And right now, the last 10 years or so in the U.S., it's been like commercial directors doing horror movies is like the thing. That's what they hire, commercial music video people, because they can give you a stock issue look that everyone's familiar with and is very slick and is very accessible to audiences. And then in Japan, like in the late 70s, they hire a commercial director who does the polar opposite of all that. And it's almost like when you think of a guy coming from an advertising background, an experimental film background, this is what you would get from it. But what we get in America is like the most milquetoast, like just make it look like everything else and it'll be successful. Whereas this is the complete opposite. This is just complete anarchy of a movie. And it has the sort of Japanese style advertising and things popping up left and right. And it's stuff that's not in other movies. And so it's like, as a film goer, how could you ignore a movie that's unlike any movie you've ever seen before? How is that not the most exciting thing?
I did mention that there would be a second announcement at the top of the episode, and I'm going to do it now. By the end of this year, Swampflix will be turning 10 years old. We've been doing this project for a while, and to commemorate that, we've been working on a group project all year, and it's still going on. We are honing in on the top 100 movies ever made, as said by us, by the 6 contributors to this website.
Yeah, according to We Freaks.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty good mix of like movies you've heard of and maybe a few deep cuts in there. Especially if you listen to the show, you've probably heard of every single one of them because we've been, you know, talking at you for 10 years solid. But part of the project is that I want to cover everything on the site in one form or another. So a lot of the podcast episodes have been kind of dictated by movies that will be on that top 100 list. So that's why it's being delayed sometime by the end of the year. I want to have that list up.
And maybe even sooner than you think, dear listener.
We're working on it. We're working on it.
Don't hold us accountable.
And maybe that will make the show a little less esoteric for a minute. I feel a little self-conscious about talking about something as foundational as House from 1977 as a topic on this episode. Because I want to say around 2009, 2010, when the Criterion Collection released a restoration disc on DVD and Blu-ray. I have the DVD because I did not own a Blu-ray player at the time. That's how long ago this was. It was like an instant film bro classic. Like the number of orange cat face t-shirts that were at every microbrewery in every major city in America was out of control.
I have a friend who I think owns one, and he does not know that that's what it is.
Wow. Wow.
Like, it made its way through the thrift shops to him, and he does not actually... We're not 100% certain. I would say that I'm 95% certain that that's what it is, but, like, you know, it's just the mouth. It's not the full cat, but mm-hmm. The image from his shirt appeared for a full frame in this movie.
And that was sold through the Criterion Collection's website. Like, that is their merch.
I thought about getting it, so maybe I'll be one of those people.
At least cut it up or something. Make it like a hip tank.
I probably will.
Yeah. It's just, like, you know, kind of intimidating to talk about something that is seminal. It's like if we were sitting down to talk about Goodfellas, which maybe we should. I don't know. But there's a lot going on here, and the impulse is usually when you talk about it to be like, this is the craziest movie ever made. It's so wacky. Which is not untrue. The director, Nobuhiko Obayashi, came up through both commercial filmmaking and abstract art films. On the Criterion disc, there's a few special features. One is like a documentary discussing the making of the movie. The other is a short film he made called Emotion. That's like a vampire movie. It's about, I think, 40 minutes long. And it is way stranger than House, structurally. It's these like two girls who eventually are pursued by a Dracula-like vampire. And it is kind of stuck somewhere in the 60s between like Todd Browning's Dracula and The Beatles' A Hard Day's Night movie. It's got a very playful sense of visual experimentation, but it's like a Maya Darren movie. Like, explaining what happens from scene to scene is completely irrelevant because it's not that kind of film. It's just like a sequence of images that make you feel strange. So at the same time he was doing those art films, he was also making TV commercials. And I think you see both of those influences in House, which is a haunted house movie that he made in the mid-70s as a response to Jaws. That's how he was hired for the project.
Yeah, which is great.
Toho wanted him to make a Japanese film that was as exciting and entertaining as Jaws. And his thought was, well, you know, a shark attacking you is pretty common. Like, most people know what a shark attack looks like. I want to make a movie where things that cannot happen in real life happen on the screen. And he talked to his young daughter, who's like a baby child, about what scares
10
her.
10 years old, yeah.
Yeah. And she was talking about, you know, like, what if my reflection in the mirror attacked me? Or she caught her fingernail on the piano keys at her piano lessons, and it's like, what if the piano attacked me? And he just kind of like made a list of all these things that his daughter was afraid of, and kind of threw them all into this one haunted house film that is both really striking pop art. Like, the commercial side of his work is so iconic that, you know, someone would buy a thrift store t-shirt not knowing where that cat face was from, because it is just like a beautiful right. piece of iconography.
Yeah.
And actually that was part of the lead up to this movie. Was there's like 2 years of advertising before the movie came out, where there were comic books, and the psychedelic band that's in the movie has an album that came out before the film did, radio plays. Like, people were aware of these characters in this story before the movie ever reached Japanese theaters. And, you know, his experimental side also shows up, where every single technique there is for a special effect, like a handmade special effect, is tried here. It's just like a free-for-all of, you know, stop motion, on-screen 2D animation, just lighting and refraction. And yeah, it's just like, it's all over the place. The main story is pretty simple. It's seven girls go on a summer vacation to one of their homes, to their grandmother's home, I believe. And she is a witch who kills all unmarried women who enter her space.
It's one of their aunts.
It's Gorgeous's aunt. It's her mother's sister.
Okay, my apologies.
The reason I correct you on this is I'm like, this is goals, you know? Really hope to be a witchy cat lady who eats young girls.
Yeah, she's also a witch and a ghost and a demon spirit. I don't know. She's just like a supernatural force that used to be this girl's aunt. And yeah. All unmarried women that enter that home are not going to leave it, which is bad news for these children who are too young to be married. And the children are all given very simple names, that so you instantly know what their characteristics are, like a comic book character.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, it's almost like a reverse, or like an inverse Snow White and the Seven Dwarves a little bit right. at the start, because it's like there's this, you know, seemingly wheelchair using elderly woman who these seven girls who are identified by their singular personality character type / tragic flaw, perhaps, immediately start cleaning her house.
Does anybody have a favorite of the seven girls? Because I have a very clear one in my
yeah,
head.
I think, and I think that we should all say it on the count of three. One, two, 3.
Kung Fu.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's clearly a coolest person here. And I'd so also cool. argue,
so cool.
Even though gorgeous and fantasy, I think, are supposed to be more of our two leads among the girls, the fact that the floating head of Kung Fu after she's killed on that field of like a repeating blue pattern is one of the major like mainstream pop culture images of what house is, means that I think people think of her more even than the characters that we spend more time with, not just because she's also the coolest.
And the other characters comment on how cool she is, like through the movie. They're constantly. Like, she's so cool.
And she's so cool. More manly than Mr. Togo. Who so we have got to talk about Mr. Togo, but we don't have to do that immediately.
He lives some kind of life.
He is okay, let's just do it. He is in a different movie. Okay.
He is.
Mr. Togo is having a wonderful adventure where him and his ridiculous jalopy are trying to get across the country to get to this country house, where he ends up having this conflict with truckers. And then he visits like a noodle house where one of the chefs is a bear.
Yeah.
And it's like, what?
Uncommented upon.
He is in a different movie. It's like, I can see it. There's like this zany comedy about Mr. Togo and his misadventures in this
Mr. Togo's buggy. Wild ride is going on over here.
And some of the Hard Day's Night, like stop motion effects. Would you call that? Like, yeah, it's like still photography stop motion, but with like a human body instead. Where he's like, his butt is stuck in the bucket and he like slides across the floor.
Yes.
Oh, yes. All of that.
Amazing.
It is funny because it made me think about all of those, because this movie makes me think of Scooby-Doo.
Yes.
There's a lot of like Hanna-Barbera energy happening in this haunted house because it's like a mind of a child.
Especially when she drops her glasses and it's like, my glasses.
she says my glasses. And in this viewing of it, I was like, God damn it, Velma. Like I actually said those exact words because but there were a bunch of Scooby-Doo knockoffs where like sometimes it was a shark and one time it was like a living dune buggy. And it's like, is that intentional? Like, are they referencing that like Hanna-Barbera Scooby-Doo knockoff with the talking dune buggy by having the girls go off on this like very Scooby-Doo-esque adventure while Mr. Togo drives his dune buggy around in like a much more like, I don't know, sitcom-y, you know, randomness series of vignettes. I don't know.
And the movie was a hit with children and teens in particular. Like the adult critics at the time kind of panned it as just being silly fluff. But it was kind of a hit among youth culture. And I would say even the Criterion re-release was like very important to like college, high school age people.
Yeah. I was given, we watched my Criterion DVD of this movie that was given to me in, I want to say like 2011, 2012 as a gift from one of our mutual friends, long-term friend of the podcast, Alan. I won't say their last name because I'm not going to dox anybody here, but shout outs to Alan if you're listening. Alan's the reason we met, so.
Yeah, and Cece actually gave me a gift of this movie too around that same time. So I also did not purchase this DVD. It is fun watching the special features. Like most of the stuff I mentioned is very much like a time capsule of the 1970s and like kind of documenting the context of this was made, which is, I think, what Criterion is good for the most part, is like, you know, cultural context. You get those little booklets, like you get a little zine with your movie.
Yeah.
Usually there's a commentary track, not for this one, but there is also a special feature that is a interview with Ty West, I guess, because he made House of the Devil around that time. And it's like, this guy makes haunted house movies. Let's, you know, have him comment on this one. And he does the full film, bro. Like, this is the craziest movie I've ever seen. It's so wacky. It's nuts. But what was interesting about that interview is it actually becomes a time capsule of 2009, 2010's era, where he was like explaining to the audience that House is different from other horror movies because it's an art film and a horror movie. And usually those two things do not combine.
Right.
He was saying like, you know, those are usually separate things. And to live in a world now where, like, maybe 5 years after that, with The Witch in particular, yeah. like A24, like, started pumping out a lot of art horror films in commercial spaces. So we're like, Ty West now feels kind of outdated and mainstream compared to most of the horror I see at the multiplex now.
Right.
I don't know. I just think that's interesting that, like, the disc itself has become a time capsule of an earlier era. And so much of my understanding of Criterion and so much of my understanding of this movie are so tied together that I can't separate them. Objectively, if I'm just going to look at the movie by itself outside those contexts, I think what really makes it work is that Scooby-Doo quality you were talking about a little bit, particularly the part in Scooby-Doo where they're like, you know, two characters run into one room and then five lead out the other door. You know, that kind of like free-for-all moment at the end of the Scooby-Doo episode before they unmask the criminal. My favorite aspect of haunted house movies is that third act release where all this tension and mystery is building. There's a lot of like questions about whether or not something supernatural is going on. And then there's always that moment where it just all releases and everything in the house goes haywire all at once. Like, you know, the furniture moves on its own. Cabinet doors are thwapping open and closed. The walls will bleed. You know, strange voices and smoke and lights will just like appear. It's just like a complete disregard for reality finally. And just like letting go of the slow tension. And I think this movie is an exceptional example in the genre just because it does not wait for that third act release. Like, it is just constant haywire mayhem before they even get to the house.
Yeah.
And then, you know, by the time it does go that extra layer and like there is another rug pull where the house itself goes haywire and starts eating the children that are inside of it, it does find a way to start at 11 and still crank it up to 12 in a convincing way. Like, it's not like monotonous. There is like an elevation in the same way that other haunted house movies have. And yeah, I just love this kind of creative free-for-all filmmaking where, like I said, Obayashi said, like, it's something that cannot happen in real life. You know, like it is like using cinema for what it's good for, which is like visualizing a dream and basically in his case, like commissioning his friends to make the weirdest art they can so that he can put it in a commercial space. And I think that's incredibly cool.
Yeah. It's amazing that, you know, a studio like Toho, like, just funded this and then's like, let them use the biggest set they can.
He had to fight for that, actually.
I feel like that's kind of like, should be thrown around in the same way, you know, ideas about Citizen Kane should be, you know, like, where it's just this bizarre masterpiece that, like, it's a miracle it got funded on the in the like way that it did.
Apparently those Toho studio spaces were like very coveted for directors that worked there for a long time, and like it was like a big deal to be able to use their like studio lots, those like inside warehouse spaces.
Yeah.
And the only reason he could get in there is because he had filmed commercial work in that space, so like the TV ads basically opened a door for him to create his own little artificial world inside of there.
Amazing.
So yeah, that's like a, you know, happenstance that, you know, the movie would not have been the same without it.
I don't know. This movie, big influence in my life. I, not to be the crazy cat lady, but I did adopt a white cat that I initially fell in love with because I was like, how's your cat? You know, it's as that level of like, I love this movie. I think about the skeleton dancing in the background of the piano music playing a lot.
That is one of my favorite bits.
I
love a prop skeleton.
Yes, we all should.
I do like that there's a lot of just like commissioned art in the movie. Like there's just a lot of like little pieces like that skeleton and a lot of paintings on the wall and stuff.
Yes.
And so many of them are of the cat in particular. You can tell that like he just gave painters like a prompt to paint this white cat looking as demonic as possible, and everybody kind of just went for it.
Yeah. I mean, it's very easy to paint white cats as demonic, even though they're sweet angel babies. Because, like, this cat in this movie, I'm just like, how do you get a cat this chill? They could just, like, be grabbed and carried around everywhere. My cats have never been that chill. But yes, it's a good cat movie, is all I'm saying, for every cat person.
I think the moment it becomes a great cat movie is when you've been hearing the same theme song for like 15 minutes solid.
Yeah.
And then the cat joins in and sings in tune.
Yes, with exactly. Melody.
It's so wonderful.
Yeah, I think of this as a cat movie because of so many of these details. I'm like, oh yes, this is a cat movie. Perfect for cat people, even though I would not recommend this to like half the cat people I know.
Also, if you are listening to this podcast and you love cats, we should go ahead and provide a late warning that The Beast also may not be for you.
Oh, yeah. I think you already described that moment of violence.
I just you did. Pet. I didn't. Yeah. Just to clarify, it's a kitty cat.
Pretty brutal.
Yeah. One of the things that I really loved about this, because I had not watched this in a long time and I had forgotten kind of how zany it was. And specifically how weird things, like you said earlier, Brandon, are even before they get to the house. Specifically, I really enjoy the bit where she's gorgeous, decides to provide the backstory of her mother and her aunt. And it plays out in like black and white silent footage.
It's like sepia tone.
Yeah, with interstitial dialogue cards.
Yeah.
Whenever a character speaks, and then the girls themselves are providing commentary on what we are watching. Like, it can't possibly work as, like, you know, they're just commenting on Gorgeous's recounting of these events. They're like specifically commenting on this, like, filmed version of that that we are watching with them. It's very like MST3K a little bit.
Yeah, their dialogue is very girlish and focused on how cute the boys are, how the mushroom cloud looks like cotton candy.
Yeah, yes. Oh my God.
So it's like a dissonance between like the horrific images we're seeing and their, you know, kind of cutesy dialogue. That's kind of horrifying.
That's the same wedding dress I'll wear one day. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, you know?
I know that he had close friends that died in Hiroshima, so... There is like a cultural context to that that's very easy to latch onto that maybe elsewhere, you know, I don't know this like ghost cat mythology as well as I should, but this story template of the cat witch and the unmarried women, you know, not being safe in that home is something that has been repeated in other Japanese media and is from an older folktale. I don't have that context, but I definitely know what happened in World War II, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and this is a very fairy tale-y kind of movie in the same way that Suspiria is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where like Suspiria, there's a lot of overlap between those two, not to be the Argento guy again, but the way that color is used, the way that they're both kind of twists on a haunted house story that involves the presence of a witch that preys on youth. They exist in a very similar space. This is obviously much like sillier, but they're very similar in a lot of ways.
I do like that the characters also have active commentary about how unreal everything is. Like,
yes.
After Kung Fu gets attacked by like flying logs out of a fireplace, she says, "This is ridiculous." Which is very like MCU.
This is ridiculous.
But it continues after that. They keep like calling the events illogical and impossible, and saying everything doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So, you know, that running commentary from the flashback continues, even as the you know, you would think at some point they'd just completely let go and be like, okay, I'm in it. But they just like they keep that artifice or that remove going.
I really appreciated that the characters and the way that they're named for their fatal flaws / singular personality traits is very much like a fairy tale thing, even in the mm-hmm. West. And the way that they have to like go away from the city to this like ancient house that is secluded is also sort of a like fairy tale story as well. And then, you know, there does seem to be something kind of princessy about Gorgeous.
Yeah.
And there's even I think is my favorite use of the weird editing in the whole movie is when very close to the end, Fantasy is still like believing, like she's still living in, you know, this dream fantasy that Mr. Togo is going to show up and save them. And she imagines herself as a princess and him as like this white knight coming through to rescue her. And there starts becoming quicker and quicker shots, or quick cuts between that fantasy and what's actually happening to her. And the length of time between those cuts gets shorter and shorter in a really interesting way, where it's like she's trying to stay in this fantasy so hard. And the reality of the external horror that's happening to her is just cutting through it, where you're watching her struggle to maintain her grip on this fantasy in a way that I thought was really cool. You know, a lot of it is intentionally meant to look like it was done by a child, but that had a real viscerality to it that I enjoyed quite a lot.
I also thought the framing, where there's like kind of a picture in picture framing, was very sophisticated too. For a movie like this, like to chop up that frame into like smaller images and like
Window. Yeah. Where it sort of makes the whole thing look like a comic book page.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's not something you would normally see in a, a children's splatter comedy, but that's not really something that happens at all.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's not something that exists at all outside of this. I mean, you know, I understand the impulse to be like, this movie's so zany and so wacky, because I don't really think there are other movies like this one. Like, it is very unique, just impossible to throw into a genre, because like you can just say, oh, it's a haunted house movie, but you know, I feel like that's also undercutting it.
Well, that's like the reason that we have genres, right? Or maybe I should say that's the reason why genre filmmaking is interesting to me.
Yeah,
because it provides you a very familiar structure so that you can kind of riff and go off without worrying about losing your audience. Like, everyone knows what a haunted house movie is, so people will follow along while you try things, you know, like you're able to stray in a way that you're not usually allowed to outside of art cinema and still maintain an audience, you know?
Yeah.
I guess what I'm resistant to is that impulse to be like, this is the craziest movie ever made.
Yes.
It's like listing off all the crazy things that happen in it.
Yeah.
I do think that's like slightly reductive for it having more going on than just trying to wow you with the unexpected. But that is an aspect of the film, though. It's not something I can disregard as like being very essential to it.
Yeah.
I just love the visual art layering. Like, that's really like what excites me about this, to the point where like even when they're outside, like when they first arrive on the bus to the rural area where the aunt's house is, they arrive in front of this like billboard, like false backdrop. So they've like, they've moved the artifice outside. The train ride there is like a little toy train, almost like they're traveling through like a pop-up picture book.
Yeah, and at points the train even completely disappears into psychedelia.
Yeah.
Even on the way there, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
I just really love this art form as like a visual medium. And it's very rare for a movie to fully commit to that aspect of it. And it wouldn't be able to do that, I don't think, without being a haunted house movie. I don't know if it's as commercial as Jaws, if that was the main intent from Toho when they gave him the green light to make this, but he definitely made something that's like visually stunning and exciting and, you know, shows you something you've never seen before while technically sticking to a genre that everybody's familiar with.
Yeah.
How do we feel about the epilogue, as I think of it? I'm not sure how I feel about this, and I'm just kind of talking it out, but I don't know that we need anything after the last of the girls dies in the house. Like, whenever Gorgeous's soon-to-be stepmother comes to the house and is killed by either a de-aged auntie who now looks like Gorgeous, or Gorgeous possessed by auntie's ghost. And then it's a really cool, I mean, of course it's a lot of fun to watch her like fly across the countryside. And she does give us the closure of what happened with Mr. Togo, which is that he turned into a pile of bananas in his car.
Of course he did.
Because of course he did. That's witchcraft, baby. Or ghost witchcraft.
I mean, that's just his life, honestly. That's just how he lives.
He might have just fashioned like a scarecrow of himself out of bananas, maybe. I would believe that. That seems like the kind of bullshit he'd get up to while these girls are getting eaten by a house.
Live a banana's life, die a banana's death.
Yeah. Live by the peel, die by the peel.
That stinger does feel like a genre convention in itself, right? Like, there's always that final beat where the evil of the day has been defeated, and then there's an extra beat where it's like, well, you know, it's like everything's quieted down, the fight is over, and then there's one more beat where it's like, this will continue on forever. Usually at the end of a horror movie.
Yes, but usually at the end of a haunted house movie, before they have that like stinger epilogue that provides some ambiguity about the villain's defeat, that requires the villain to be defeated. The house wins in this movie. Like, yeah. Those girls are dead. Like, no one escapes, no one survives, you know, they're all just dead. And so it doesn't have the same feeling. It's like it is there because that's something that happens in a haunted house movie. But normally in a haunted house movie, you have a survivor or two who are then able to be threatened in that stinger. So this just brings back, you know, soon to be Mrs. Gorgeous's dad. And just like, because she's an unmarried woman and she's the last one left in the script, she has to show up and get immolated. But we never for a moment are like not concerned about her, because she's just going to go to that house and get eaten. It's like she speed runs the rest of the movie. You know, I don't know how I feel about that.
I mean, I think it's satisfying in a way of like, she was already mad at this lady coming in and taking her mom's place. And then, you know, that whole idea of like, you're never going to be my mom, and dying in her mom's childhood home. I don't know. It's kind of a full circle in that way, but like, yeah, it's a weird one. That.
I was just thinking about it as like a release of tension too. Like, there's kind of this like airy, dreamy quality to all of her scenes. Like,
yeah.
Picturing like a diaphanous gown, or she's like long scarf kind of like flowing in the wind, you know?
Always has that long scarf.
She travels with a wind machine everywhere she goes.
Yeah. It's like her scenes are in slow motion. And after all that, like, piano eating and decapitation and blood spewing and cat demonic zaniness, like, even her death feels kind of like a relaxing breath. Which is terrible to say. But there's, like, a calming, dreamlike, like, warm bath feeling to that final scene.
Yeah.
I do appreciate, you know, the billowing. She does, she 95% of the billowing in this movie is just her in those last 3.5 minutes. So good on it.
Let's break down the characters. We've talked about Gorgeous, who is kind of our POV character, like the leader of the pack,
mm-hmm.
because she's gorgeous. That gives her like social capital.
Yeah. That again is something that felt very fairy tale to me, because fairy tales, because of their nature and their like how ancient they are, you can get away with having a character just named Beauty or mm-hmm. Sleeping Beauty, you know. Right. And so having a character named Gorgeous right from the start gives it some of that fairy tale fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of fantasy, another character that we've mentioned already and believes in the fairy tale romance of this scenario.
Yeah.
Melody. I mean, all she has going on is that she plays music, which...
Yeah, she plays music.
Sets up the piano gag, which is nice. And the piano tune that, you know, lilts through this house and puts everyone in a dream state is very essential to the feeling of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
As quickly paced and psychedelic as everything is, there's this, like, airy, dreamlike tone to that like, really slows things down sometimes when it needs to. Similarly, Mac... short for stomach.
My second favorite.
She has one characteristic.
Yeah.
She likes to eat stuff.
It's funny because they bully her, a very petite, normal sized girl, so fat. I don't know if that's part of the joke or if that's cultural, but like,
that is cultural for sure.
She just looks strong. She just looks like, you know, sporty. There's not, you couldn't pinch a piece of fat on her anywhere. And they constantly are like, God, you fucking pig. Don't you ever think about anything but stuffing your face, you fat fuck. Like they're teasing her playfully. What's funny is, even though she's bullied in a way that's very familiar to me, God, she really, I love her. She has an indomitable spirit, and it kind of sucks that she's one of the first to go.
She just takes it just par for the course. She's like, yeah, whatever. I have a healthy appetite.
And I don't think it's like a Charlie and the Chocolate Factory situation where you're supposed to find her disgusting. I think the audience is supposed to enjoy her as a character. And like, I mean, when you're a little kid, you're watching her eat big pieces of watermelon and giant cookies and stuff. And you're like, I want one of those too. I love to eat snacks.
Yeah.
R.I.P. Mac, you would have loved those noodles made by a bear.
Yes. Yes.
She was the first to go, unfortunately. And then we have a duo. I think, you know, paired up is Sweet and Professor. Yeah. And I think those two are like paired off. Like Sweet is very skittish and scared because she's a sweet one and like kind of, you know, delicate. And the professor is like, well, ghosts aren't real, so none of this is anything. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Smarty pants.
I don't think that Sweet is characterized really as being... her whole deal is just that she's going to clean the whole house, right?
Right.
It's Fantasy who has the, like, the fears and everything that everybody teases her about for not being real. Sweet seems fearless right up until she gets dissolved under a pile of blankets or whatever. All she does is clean. And then she doesn't seem to have any fear. She does seem to be the only one who remembers that witch cats can close doors or something.
Yes. Any cat can open a door. Only witch cats can close them. Which, I have a cat that can't open any doors, but can close all of them and lock himself in a room. So, I don't know.
I thought that in the woods in particular, she and the professor were like going back and forth. But maybe professor's just playing party mom to like several characters because she's like the responsible, level-headed one.
Yeah.
Yeah, the thing about Sweet is there's almost nothing to her. She is the least characterized.
Right.
Her whole thing is just like as soon as they get there, she's like, I'm going to clean. And then later in the movie, she's like, I'm going to clean up. Like that's kind of all that she does. And then asks where the bedding is. Yeah, and goes looking for it.
It would be pretty sweet if a child came over and cleaned my house for me. I'd be into that.
Yeah, right?
And then finally, Kung Fu, who just kicks ass. I mean, the most proactive character, the most dynamic, the most fun to watch. Leaps through the air a bunch.
I mean, she almost saves the day. She's so close to saving
Is it her
the day.
And Professor that last the longest?
It's her and
no,
Fantasy.
It's Fantasy.
Fantasy. Okay.
Fantasy and Prof last to the end.
Yeah.
They're on the door, and then Prof loses her glass. Or they're on the... I thought of it as a door because of Titanic. It's not. It's like a floor
tile.
It's
not a door, yeah.
That's floating on the blood sea, and then Prof drops her glasses in, and then falls in and dissolves, and then Sweet ends up crawling into Auntie/Gorgeous's lap and just dying.
Yeah.
And there you have it. That's our gang.
That's our gang.
Yeah.
I do love the idea that there were, like, comic books and radio plays leading into this where like there really isn't a lot of lore and so much of like what you're enjoying is the visual eccentricities of it. So it would be interesting to like see maybe that supplementary material that should have been on the Criterion disc is like seeing what that was like, you know?
Yeah, I can't imagine like if you tried to track that down, it would be financially easy.
I mean, hopefully it was archived at all. I mean, who knows?
That's true.
I do think that it's interesting that this one, with its sort of weird, dreamy atmosphere, in a lot of ways, there are a lot of things that seem to, like, presage the Nightmare on Elm Street series.
Oh, yeah.
Specifically the way that Melody gets eaten up by the piano. Like, that feels like a Freddy Krueger gag, you know?
It really does.
And it kind of looks like one, too. And it's interesting because I don't think there's any way that Wes Craven would have seen this movie. Like, it was not released outside of Japan until, like, the 2010s, right?
Not that I'm aware of.
So, like, I don't see how Wes Craven could have seen this and been inspired by it or anything, but...
I kind of respect House more than the Nightmare series because one of my pet peeves in horror is when you're watching a movie... where all of the supernatural stuff is neatly contained in dreams. Now, Nightmare on Elm Street sidesteps this a little bit.
Yeah.
Because he comes out of the dream. The dream world doesn't affect the real world, the real one, depending on what movie you're watching. But, and you know, what happens in the dream happens to you in real life. But I do get annoyed a lot when I'm watching. I'm thinking specifically of this movie Nanny that got a lot of good reviews recently. And it's like a social thriller in that like post Get Out style where it was like about a social topic, but it was using horror tropes to talk about it. And in the movie, there are a bunch of dreams with like these like spider gods, and there's like a bathtub drowning. I'm trying hard to remember details of the movie from like 3 years ago, but all of the horror elements are very neatly sectioned off to the dream stuff. So it's always like, well, this didn't actually happen in real life. This is just a nightmare reflection of the real stuff that's happening. And House does not play that game at all. Like, that is real life that we're watching.
Yeah, and I think that, like, that is the form of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, is that the violence happens in the nightmare. And whatever happens to you there happens to you in real life because of Freddy. But I understand that as a complaint, like, that I don't know. As to take, like, a quick detour into, like, the Wes Craven body of work, one of the things that I think is an original sin in the Scream franchise is that that film is the first one in which we see something that happens only in a character's mind or in their dreams. And I think that the reason that that franchise works the most when it works is that it has a little bit of a true crime vibe. You never really get outside of the perspective of what's actually happening at any given time. And that one of the weaker elements of the sort of like reboot, requels or whatever that came out within the past few years is that we do have a character who specifically has visions of like her father, her dead father.
Yeah.
And it is the worst thing about those movies, but the original sin is in Scream 3, which was still in Craven's hands, where we see Sydney's nightmares about her mother. And I think that they're is a segregation in his work between like reality and either the unconscious or the subconscious or the dreaming world that's like that is omnipresent in his work. And so I don't mind that the nightmare sequences are always in the surreality of the dreamscape. And when it stops being that, like whenever in Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare, the sixth film, that you start to see more of like Freddy effects in the real world. Like he throws that kid out into the world to bring his daughter back to him. That's where I think it actually sucks the most.
I just think it shows like a lack of imagination for what the art form can do. Like, why are you limiting yourself to real world logic in an art form that is completely free of that? And like, that's the difference between Nightmare and House for me. It's like, you don't have to create a scenario where it's okay to play with the physicality of the real world. You're already in a dream. You're already in an artificial remove where anything is possible. And like, I'm not saying that every movie has to do that. I just think when I see stuff like this that really goes for it and like really embraces that aspect of the medium, I always have the feeling of like, finally, somebody is using this tool for what it was created for. God damn it.
Like, yeah. Creatively, there is something that, you know, if you're a person who's writing or creating this, providing yourself some limitations on what you're allowed to do can be creatively fulfilling in its own way. But I don't disagree with you about the fact that, like, as a sort of like surreal nightmare, this is much better than any of those movies, as much as I love them.
Yeah, I was going to say, I love Nightmare on Elm Street, but not as much as I love this one.
I'm also, for the record, not hating on Nightmare on Elm Street.
I
love those movies a lot. It's just like, it does feel a little restricted comparatively. But a lot of movies feel restricted compared to this one.
It's hard to be less restricted than this one, I would say.
Without losing your audience, yeah. Any less restricted than this and you were making art films, not commercial ones. And this director had been in the trenches making both and knew how to synthesize these two impulses.
Yeah.